So we built a fire pit in this quarantine time.
Oh, that's pretty exciting.
It has been exciting, and we're working with our daughter to stay in bed until the appropriate time to get up, because she's really a big fan of waking up early, and the others of us in the house are not as big a fans of that. And so all week long, we've been working towards this reward of, hey, if you do this, we're going to make s'mores in the fire pit. Because we've had this new fire pit, and we haven't gotten to make a fire and make s'mores yet. And now it's raining all day. And so she's like actually worked really hard and has earned this reward, and now it's raining all day. And so I'm still going to have a very, very sad child when I come home.
I don't know what the compromise is there, too. You can make s'mores over the stovetop.
Doesn't seem like a safe choice, does it? I mean, I've seen people do this, and every time I see it, I'm like, that really just seems like a fire waiting to happen. Like, I mean, yeah. I don't know. We'll see. We'll figure something
out. It probably is. Yeah, because the marshmallow's going to catch on fire. They're going to fling their little stick around.
Exactly.
And you have a flaming ball of marshmallow flying through your home.
Yeah, exactly what I'm looking for. So yeah. I will deal with some tears and probably give her a popsicle or something, and she'll be good for now, and then we'll do the s'mores later.
Sure. Popsicle solves it.
Yeah.
All right, well, welcome back to the Beyond Sunny
podcast.
To
the days when a popsicle smelled all, or not smelled, solved all, when a popsicle solved all.
Sure. We're taking our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff with me, as always, Pastor David Bowser.
How are we doing, Patrick?
And back again, Elise McCarter. You're still a pre-successful writer. You didn't get sell any best-selling books or anything like that?
Not in the last week, no. I'm a little disappointed, to be honest with you.
So this week on the podcast, we said we're going to kind of do a part two of last week. So last week we talked a lot about race relations in the United States. If you have not watched, listen to that podcast or watch the video we post on our Facebook page, we strongly suggest you do that. And here we're going to take a look at some criticisms, or not necessarily criticisms, but kind of how people have responded to racism in the United States.
Yeah.
Now there's thousands of different responses. Every person has a different response. We can't cover all. So these are five that we kind of found that we feel do a good job of one, encapsulating a general sense, and two, things that we feel from our perspective can address. We are not experts. We're not sociologists or historians. We are Pastor David and I are church workers. Elise is a writer. We're here to give our perspective as members of the ELCA. This is how we see these criticisms or these critiques of this movement.
So and we should just say, I mean, this is how we as individuals see this too, right? We're not trying to speak on behalf of all Lutherans or all church workers or all parents or all writers. Like, I mean, this is us. This is just us talking about the issues as we see them.
Yes. So I've got some news to get you on, and this news I think will help lead us in. I'm sure we've seen one of the effects of the protests have been a lot of monuments and statues coming down. Some by force, some by kind of mob justice. I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. I went to Robert E. Lee High School, so I can say I am familiar with Confederate imagery in my town and in my life.
I was just talking to somebody about you going to Robert E. Lee High School. We were having that conversation the other day. Yeah.
Oh, and I am pro tearing down Confederate monuments in city places. This is not mean I want kids to learn about the Confederacy. I want them to learn about the Civil War. But never once have I thought, I'd really like to learn something. Where are the statues in my area? You know, go to museums, books. Those are the places that learning, for me, would happen. Statues, I feel, are reserved for people who've made a lasting contribution to our country or our community.
Mm-hmm.
And traitors who fought a war against the United States don't deserve that as a statue. Or they don't deserve to get high schools named after it, in my opinion. Again, mm-hmm. my opinion. So here's Columbus, Ohio. Columbus has come under fire.
Hey, I'm familiar with Columbus, Ohio.
I bet you are. So Columbus has come under fire. Not the city, but the person Christopher Columbus.
The human being.
Mass genocide. Maybe some dealings that we just want to say, like, those weren't necessarily right as, a person.
Yeah.
And yet, it's part of the history of the United States, undeniable part of the history of the United States. So I remember this, remembering a little rhyme growing up of, like, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's backwards. But yeah, you got the date right, so that's good.
That's backwards. He did not sail
in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Yeah, 1492 comes first.
This is how they did it in San Antonio, Texas.
Well, okay, San Antonio, Texas, everything's backwards. So,
So, Elise, how did they handle this in South Carolina?
Oh, we didn't go to school in South Carolina.
Yeah. We just stayed home. Problem solved.
Elise is homeschooled.
To be clear, I was homeschooled. So I also am familiar with the rhyme. Is that what you were asking?
Yes. All right. So anyway, a petition is okay. There to rename Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah.
To honor a Columbus native, Guy Fieri. So they want to rename Columbus Flavor Town.
Oh no.
So that's the petition going around. 8,000 signatures so far on Flavor Town as the name of Ohio.
Now, Ohio's new capital, Flavor Town. That's
you have a greater connection to Columbus than I do, Pastor.
I have a pretty strong connection to Columbus, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think? Flavor Town is the new name.
I am not pro Flavor Town. I am pro considering better ways to, I don't know, changing the name of the city is tough. I mean, I get that. And, you know, it's not the same as just deconstructing or reconstructing a monument or changing a school. And there are a lot of things to think about there. But I would be open to conversation about a different name or at least a better way of recognizing the mixed history of the person for whom Columbus is named. Flavortown should not be the name of a city, of any city. I mean, I guess you could name a restaurant that, but I'm not sure that I'd go to it.
Yeah,
can you imagine being a kid, I mean, like growing up and maybe like, where are you from? I'm like, oh yeah, I'm from Flavortown, Ohio. Like having to like write that on addresses and like no job application would take you seriously. They're like, oh, this just throw this out with the Superman and the Queen America or Queen Elizabeth. Like these people aren't real applications. It's just a fake thing from Flavortown. It's not a real person.
Now, are there any professional sports teams in Flavortown or Columbus?
Yeah, there's the Columbus Blue Jackets are a professional hockey team.
So the Flavortown Blue Jackets.
Yeah, the Flavortown Blue Jackets. You'd also have the Columbus Crew, the Flavortown Crew. That's the soccer club. There's a minor league baseball team. What was the baseball team's name? The Columbus. Oh shoot, I don't remember the minor league baseball team. But anyway, they'd now be the Flavortown whatevers.
Yeah, I'm sure. Look, in my opinion, if you rename Flavortown, all those things need to become. They need to be rebranded as foods. Like that's just what has to happen.
Obviously, like it's the only logical choice.
Sure. So the Flavortown chicken wings needs to definitely be, you know, maybe their hockey team or their baseball team.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Elise, here? Yeah. Any foods here for Flavortown sporting events? Yeah.
Yeah. My first guess was going to be hot wings.
Sure. Yeah.
Flavortown hot wings.
Strong contestant. Yeah.
That feels like a hockey team to me, though.
Yeah. I like the irony.
You
have
the red
there.
Wings.
Yeah. There you go.
And so you have the hot wings. Yeah.
Sure.
All right. So there you go. I think. Flavortown is a little silly. I'm with you. Renaming cities or states, that's where we really kind of get like, oh, this is pretty complex. I'm not saying wrong.
Yeah.
But removing a statue is relatively easy.
I can basically do that, right? I mean, give me a crane and it's fine.
Yeah. This can happen in a day and life goes back to normal.
I don't even have to know what I'm doing and I can knock it over. That's not a problem.
All right. So we are going to get into kind of these critiques that we've seen.
Okay.
From people out there. So maybe let me throw it to you guys. Have you seen critiques to greater talks about racism, Black Lives Matter in social media squares or online or in person? Have you heard these critiques of this movement?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sure probably, unless you're not engaged at all, you're going to see critiques of some kind.
Yeah.
And I think... For me, some are more valid than others. One, what we don't have to really get into here, but to start off, like, I think even like a statement like Black Lives Matter is weird or difficult because for many people it could mean just a statement in and of itself.
Yeah.
And for many other people, it is an actual movement with goals behind it.
Yeah.
And so those are two different things. And so engaging with them is difficult because you're talking about two different things and they can... The person engaging with the Black Lives Matter online could be referencing one and forgetting the other. And so that can be difficult.
I had an experience yesterday, actually, on Facebook, so you know it's going to be good, I think that all of us have a heightened awareness and we're just like super tuned in and trying to like be conscious of everything. And so we're all ready to jump at anything that we see. And I tend to stay back from Facebook conversations because really what good is going to come from it? And yesterday was further proof that no good is going to come from it. But so this person that I knew from back in South Carolina is a huge Disney fan. Like, they're one of the people that go every year and, like, had her own little memorial service. When
was
Disney
it Elise?
It was not Elise. It was not Elise. Different Disney fan. But so the news came out yesterday, or I don't, yesterday or 2 days ago, that they were they're going to be redoing Splash Mountain, and they're going to get rid of the Song of the South theme and redo it as a Princess and the Frog theme. And this person just put up an art, or put up a link to the article, and said, "This is infuriating." That's all she said. And, like, this is somebody that I'm like, this should not be infuriating for you. Like, you're someone who I see posting about Black Lives Matter stuff all the time. Like, this should not be a thing. And so I, like, genuinely am curious and try to jump on this, be like, I don't understand. Like, this, you know, the Song of the South has clearly racist portrayals of stereotypes, this, that, and the other. Like, you know, Disney doesn't even put this video out anymore, so even kids who go don't know this story. It's not like this is some deep connect. Her entire argument about this had nothing to do with racism. It was all about Princess Tiana should have her own thing in the Disney princess world and shouldn't be, like, shoehorned into some corner over in Frontierland, a whole bunch of stuff I did not understand or care about. And, yeah, so it was that, for me, it was that demonstration of, wow, we are just so heightened to everything that, like, I was ready to, like, pounce on this issue that I thought was, like, this racial justice issue that somebody's concerned about, and she's coming back with, no, I just want Princess Tiana to have her ride over here in this part of the park. I don't want this ride to be, I want it to go over there. And so I think we just have to be aware of how sensitive we are to respond to things, as well as how sensitive people who are saying things are. I mean, everybody's just on edge. And I think taking deep breaths before we enter any of these conversations would always help us. Also, don't do it on Facebook. It's probably not going to make a difference.
It does not. Yeah. Yeah. I know, Elise, you're a Disney fan. Any thoughts on the Princess and the Frog, Splash Mountain?
Sure. I mean, I grew up actually on, like, the Uncle Remus stories, which come from Song of the South.
Sure.
I guess it was just not understood that that was sensitive material at the time. And so I knew the story behind Splash Mountain. To me, Splash Mountain has always been sort of separate in my mind from Song of the South itself, because they don't use, you know, any of the bits and pieces of Song in the South that are, you know, horribly racist stereotypes. So I had never really thought about it too much. That being said, you know, if it causes harm to people, of course I'm pro changing it, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, I see no issue here. Like, who's this going to affect? Like, I mean, Disney's going to foot the bill and change it.
The ride itself will not change in any way beyond the branding. Yeah. You know, you'll still go down Splash Mountain.
Yep.
You know,
the end of it, you're going to get wet. That's going to.
And Tiana did need something. Where's Tiana?
And I agree, but I definitely agree Princess of the Frog deserves its own ride. It's a great movie. I love Princess of the Frog. I think it's really good. So I think we're seeing this, right? Like, we're seeing heightened tensions. We're going to go over through these things, kind of give our opinions, kind of go over these, how we feel about these. Some of these, I can say personally, I feel have more weight to them than others.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll kind of explore those together. So the first one I want to say is, this is something I've heard and I've seen memes about and things like that on Facebook. And that is, if you don't want to be harassed or stopped by the cops or be a victim of police brutality, just don't do the wrong things.
Sure.
People who don't do the wrong things, that does not happen to them. Kind of that mentality. So let's maybe take a look to digest this. Just this idea of, like, if you don't do the wrong things, you're going to be okay. So what do we think about this?
I think that the evidence would say differently. First of all, you know, there are plenty of people who have not been doing any of the wrong things and have still suffered from police brutality based on misunderstandings or, you know, whatever the case is, it still does happen. I think to say, you know, if you do everything perfectly, you will not be a victim of police brutality is just burying your head in the sand, because it does happen.
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't police brutality, but the Ahmaud Arbery story that we've talked about, right? I mean, he was running through a neighborhood and was a victim of vigilante justice. Because they falsely identified him based on something that had happened in the neighborhood. He hadn't done anything wrong. He was running through a neighborhood, which is perfectly legal. I do it three or four times a week. And, you know, I was having a time last night. I was running on a track here in the Woodlands, and the gate is open to this track, and so I've never had felt the problem of going in and running on it. But there is a sign that says athletics facility for school use only. And so I've had a thought a couple of times, like, man, what would happen if I were out here on a track and a police officer drove by? Because they circle past the school semi-frequently, you know, and I have never thought to myself, man, if I was here on this property doing something that is probably against code, I'm probably technically trespassing based on this sign. I have never thought to myself my life could be in danger. But when I hear stories from my black brothers and sisters, brothers in particular, they say, when I see those signs, I know I can't go. Like, I know that my life could genuinely be in danger, even if I'm just doing the same thing you're doing, right? Yeah. I'm in there. I'm using the track as it's meant to be used. I'm not causing a problem. I'm not making lots of noise. I'm just running in a circle over and over. And, you know, but I'm probably not supposed to be there. I'm probably breaking the law when I do that. And it's just a different reality of how we experience that. And I would have to get statistics and point to something more specific. But from things that I've read and heard, you know, people will say, well, more white people have encounters with the police, or more white people are, you know, arrested or ticketed or fined by the police. But proportionately to the percentage of the population that we serve, it is a higher percentage of African Americans of that population. So if you have 100 African Americans and 100 white people, you know, maybe I'm making up numbers, but to make the point, right? Maybe it's 50 of the African Americans, and maybe it's only 25. But if you multiply that out to the percentages, then it seems like there's more. I'm doing a really bad job of explaining math on the podcast.
I think that does give a good idea of what it is. Like, the black population makes around 13% of the population.
Yeah.
And yet, what we talked about last week in statistics in our video, if they are imprisoned for drug use at 50% of the incarceration rate, that is disproportionate to where they are. Right. And so then you start to have to ask your question, which I think the statistics, again, go against, like, do black people just commit more crimes?
Right.
And again, that's going to be tough for us on this podcast to really dive deep into. But I do think that the statistics are not going to necessarily lead completely to that conclusion. So yeah. I do have one last thing here on the don't do the wrong thing. So when I watched this video of a young man in California who cops pull up, he's at a gas station. They ask him, put your hands in the air, lay down. He has a hammer in his pocket, which is weird, but it's not illegal.
Yeah.
He does all those things and is killed by the police. And I'm just thinking, what could he have done different? Like, what possible thing was on the table for him to do that would not lead to death? And this was a white man. It wasn't a black man. This was, you know, again, like, this isn't just a black crime, or this isn't just happened to the black community. Again, I think disproportionately it does.
Yeah.
But this is something that could happen to everyone. Mm-hmm. That person did nothing wrong. And then the last thing I think is, I don't really want the police to execute people in the street for misdemeanors or even low-level felonies here. That's not their job. Like, it's not to be an executioner in the street. If George Floyd did pass off a $10 counterfeit bill, I think in Minnesota, it's maximum 100 years, or 1 year behind bars, not 100 years, 1 year behind bars. That's the maximum penalty, not suffocation.
Right.
Like, so that, and even if you do the wrong things, the cops aren't supposed to kill you.
Yeah.
Like,
when we are innocent until proven guilty, right? The police are intentionally not supposed to be the deciding factor in whether or not you are guilty of a crime. Their job is to bring you into the system, the justice system, so that you have an opportunity for a day in court, and so that, you know, depending on the situation, so that a jury of your peers can determine if you are guilty of that crime, and you can see. I mean, a whole lot of things that are wrong with that.
Yeah. So let's go to the next one. So I think this is interesting here. So one of the things I see a lot of, racism is not a societal issue. It is at its core a heart issue. That's the key, is you have to remove racism from people's hearts, not just from societal structures.
Yeah, I got some feelings on this, but I'm going to let Elise go first because I got to get a minute to get myself together here.
I think that that's just a really handy excuse to ignore your culpability and your responsibility to step up to the plate and make things better for everybody. It may be a hard issue. That may be a piece of it. But also when people are talking about racism in this context, we're not talking about prejudice, really, right? I mean, because that's when you say racism is a hard issue, you're talking about prejudice, like one person judging another person based on the color of their skin. What we're talking about here is systematic racism. So it's laws and procedures and biases put into place over centuries even to discriminate systematically against people based on the color of their skin. So that is not a hard issue. That is a systematic justice issue.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I want to back up from racism for a moment, and I want to talk about sin as a starting place, right? You know, we have this understanding of sin within the church where we talk about like original sin sometimes, which I go back and forth on if that's a helpful way to think about it. But let's just think about sin in general. Our understanding is that no human being can live the perfect life. That in order to live the perfect life, you'd have to be Jesus. And because we don't live a perfect life, we need a savior like Jesus. That's how we live in this place that we call sin that separates us from God. And so we look at like the Ten Commandments and we think that we can look through, oh, well, I've never killed anybody. So at least I've got that one, right? Check, done. And then Jesus comes along and is like, look, if you've spoken ill of your brother, you've committed murder in your heart. And you're like, oh, shoot. All right, so I can't check that one off. And they're like, okay, well, I've never committed adultery, Jesus. At least I'm good on that one, right? I've never messed around with my wife or anything like that. Like, I've been faithful my whole life. And then Jesus comes back and is like, look, if you've ever looked at a woman with lust in your heart, you've committed adultery. And then we're all like, oh, shoot. So the emphasis that Jesus puts in here is like, look, the point is not get over the bar so that you can be good enough. Your heart is not good enough, right? That is not the purpose of this. And in the same way, changing each of our individual hearts is not good enough to fix the brokenness of the system in which Elise is describing, right? Like, we talked about this, I think, last week, or maybe this was off podcast, I don't remember. But we talked about this idea that you could have an entire police force where every person there was faithfully and meaningfully trying to work against racism, and they were doing everything they could. It is still a system that is placed in place that disproportionately affects people of African American descent and people in minority cultures, not just African Americans, we've talked about before. Mm-hmm. It disproportionately affects and oppresses that group. And just fixing your own heart is not enough. You need an outside force to address the larger issue, just as Jesus came in to address the larger issue of the sin of humanity to restore that relationship. We need a larger system to be addressed in order to fix this larger problem.
Yeah, I think, one of the things I'm thinking about this too is like, one, sometimes I'm unaware of the bias in my own heart, sure. Like that I am completely blind to without, you know, seeing a reflection in some other, whether that's through society or through other people, being like, wow, I do have these things and they do need to be worked on. And so saying it's a heart issue sometimes was like, well, maybe you're always thinking other people's hearts need to change and not my heart needs to change on the thing. And the other thing is, that's really dismissive, right? Like if we, you know, are like, had this podcast and you're like, one of our things we're championing is like, being anti-human trafficking, which is egregious. Yeah. And you heard, you know, the real problem with human trafficking is it's a heart issue. Laws and things like that, like that's not going to do anything. We got to get to the hearts of the human traffickers. You're like, yeah, but there's laws and procedures we can put in place, right, to curb and make sure this does not happen. Whether it's global slavery, slavery part of our stained history, it's part of the stained history of the world. Mm-hmm. It's more than just a heart issue. Like, it's more than that. It needs to it is a big issue that it's not just, if everybody was just a Christian, it would be solved.
Right.
Because there's places where everybody's a Christian, and it's still not great. Like, yep. It can still be tough for people. I also could look at the next one. I've seen this one, too, from people saying, well, personally, my own heart is fine because I don't see color.
Yeah.
And so this is something I've heard. I've heard people that I love and respect say. I've heard people, that I'm connected to say. I've never said this because I can say I do see color, like in the very real way. Like, I know when people are black or white. Like, yeah. I think, like, so let's talk about this. Like, I don't see color. How do you respond to that if you're seeing that as kind of the comments on Facebook? What do you think?
I don't know if you all grew up with the same attitude, but at least where I was in Ohio, I remember this being like kind of a central theme of diversity education as a child. That like not that they came out and said like, oh, you shouldn't see color, but it was that, oh, you should look at everybody as the same, right? Everybody's the same. You shouldn't acknowledge differences, and that's not the purpose of the purpose of tearing down racism is not to make everybody the same. The purpose of tearing down racism is to make sure that everybody can be treated equally by the system, but we're still supposed to look at and acknowledge and celebrate the differences that each of us have, right? God gave us these unique bodies and these unique ways of moving and living in the world so that we can celebrate one another, so that we can highlight the gifts that each of us bring to the table. So I genuinely think it came, at least from my experience, it came from a loving place, right? It came from a place of, we don't want to see color because when we see color, people are not treated fairly. So if we don't see color, then we'll treat everybody fairly, right? I mean, that's the mentality. It just has played itself out terribly. It's played itself out to say, well, I don't see color, so I'm not part of the problem, and it's become an excuse. In the same way that, right, circumcision was given as a gift to the Israelites to be a sign of the promise that God bestows upon them, and they turn it into a curse and make it a weight that we have to bear. We do this all the time, where we take something that's meant for good and turn it into harm.
I feel the same way. I'm going to take it back to Disney for a moment. I think nice. That for those of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, it feels to me like it's part of like the Disney generation, like the circle of life.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. So I think that's sort of a direct result of all of us growing up in that. It's like, oh, we don't see color. We're all equal. We're all one, you know. Which in some ways is great, right? But again, it becomes an excuse for, you know, oh, it's just bad for everybody, you know, so I'm not going to acknowledge that it is disproportionately bad for one group of people.
I think it also comes out of some of our own discomfort as white people of talking about it, right? Because if I can just say, well, I don't see color, then I don't have to talk about the fact that I have some issue or some thing that I don't want to acknowledge, right? And I don't think it's malicious, but I think it becomes a shield to protect us from having to talk about something that is difficult or challenging or uncomfortable.
Yeah, like the same way we probably react to white privilege, the term, you know, like we're all defensive about that. But I don't like the I don't see color.
Yeah, I think it can come from a biblical place. I mean, in like Galatians and a couple other places, Paul will write like there is no difference between male and female, circumcised, uncircumcised, Greek and Jew, slave and free. And I think it's, and that is a beautiful section. That is an important key part of Paul's theology and what we take away from that. But I don't think in those things, like we're saying, like the unique gifts of different cultures or different genders can really just be washed away. I don't want to live in a, you know, world where it's just androgyny, where everybody's exactly the same. I don't think that is truly the desire, what heaven will look like. It's more of a celebration of how everybody's uniqueness is fully expressed. And part of that uniqueness is based on their gender. It's going to be based on their sexuality. It's going to be based on their race. It's going to be based on their culture, where they grew up from, their country. All those things are part of that. And so I think I don't see color kind of says all the things that you value about yourself, especially, you know, a black community that's saying like, hey, we value our blackness or our African roots. Saying that kind of says like, you shouldn't, like, like those things go away.
Yeah.
And I think I agree with you both, though well-meaning, I don't think it really solves anything. I don't think it really gets there.
I'm also just going to throw in, I just thought of this from as an additional thought, right? If we think of, and I don't know colors well enough to know this for sure, but I think that white is actually like the absence of pigment, right? So like when you have like a white paint, it's because there's no pigment in it. And so to say like, I don't see colors is basically saying, well, I see everything as white. I mean, it's another way to think of that. And I don't think it's malicious, but it's the way of saying, well, everything's the way I am supposed to be. And that's how I see the world.
Yeah. My point of view is the default, and yeah. So I'm converting everybody to how I think the world should be. I agree with that. So we have two more that I want to look at. And for me, I think that these, not to say these other ones are meritless, I think these next two have the most merit. I think that there's some nuance here that I do think is interesting.
Okay.
All right. So one is this idea of like, well, part of why the black community has a greater run-in with laws and greater problem with law enforcement and authority is that there's a greater percentage of kids growing up without a father in that community. So a greater chance of being in from a single parent home. And so that's part of that problem is fatherlessness. And I want to say from the get-go, I'm going to say this right now, I grew up without a father. So like, I need, you know, that's, I understand in a sense what it means to grow up from divorced parents without a strong male father figure in my home. Mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. So let's digest this a little bit about what does this mean, fatherlessness in especially the black community?
Yeah.
What do you think?
So Pastor Gary is reading this book, and I'm going to apologize because I don't remember the name of it, but he was telling me about it just in one of our conversations the other day, and it's kind of laying out some of the history of race relations going back to pre-Civil War, so you know, still in the slave-ridden South, and talking about one of the practices was pretty common to separate husbands and wives onto different plantations, and it especially happened after the wives were pregnant. And so the wives would give birth, and the fathers would be sent to another plantation or working somewhere else. And so it kind of embedded a piece of this culture that was forced upon them by their slave owners, this separateness of fathers, that fathers were removed from the picture. And so there grew up to be a more matriarch-centered system, you know, where you had more respect for grandma or for mom or those women who were raising you. And I think we still hear a lot of those stories from the conversations that I have with people about how they were raised, that those female figures were really important in their life. And so I think, you know, one, it's kind of like we're now saying, well, yeah, you don't have these father figures because, and we're ignoring the fact that they don't have these father figures because of a culture that was thrust on them because of our predisposition as the ones who were owning them as slaves, right? And so we're saying, well, now you have to fix it. And so we're saying, we've made this problem for you, but now you have to fix it, without ever providing any social structure or construct or assistance to help facilitate that process. And so I think that a piece of that denies our role even in that issue, right? Like, yeah, I didn't walk into somebody's house and cause the dad to leave, but there's a history of oppression that has led to this culture, which has a mindset that's passed from generation to generation. As you talked about last week with systemic stuff, you know, listed out in like King David's story of that sin being passed from generation to generation. It affects generations, you know, what, 150 years now post-Civil War.
Yeah, I think it's you know, again, from the outside culture, you know, from a white person coming in and saying like, hey, black men do a better job. I think that sounds, suspect at best. But I think when, a lot of times I'm hearing, you know, members of the black community speaking out against this and saying like the men and fathers do need to do a better job of being present in their children's life. And I think, yes, that is valid. I think that's a very valid thing. I do think that statistically growing up in a single parent home, you're more likely to have hardships than if you grew up in a two parent home. It's just that part of that process is you're losing out on, you know, 50% of attention, 50% of education, 50% of a person that could be there for you. That is true. Again, I grew up without a dad, so I understand the feelings of anger, hurt, rage, all those things wrapped inside yourself and not knowing what to do with it, that without a strong positive male role model, especially in the life of a young boy. I get that those are things. So last week I quoted a Bible verse in Isaiah that I think is important for systematic racism, how the prophet is speaking to a generations of what they need to do. And 17 says, learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed. And I think it's a beautifully summed up, like, this is what Israelite is called to do. And also what is like countries are called to do to root out systematic injustice. The next line in this is take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow. And for me, this means even if there's a segment of the population that's growing up without a father, are a greater percentage of lack of fathers, it's not just that their issue. Like Isaiah is telling you, the country has a responsibility to look for the fatherless and care for them, and not say, hey, dads get better, or women don't go after dads who are no good. It's like the societal community's responsibility to take care of kids that are in that situation.
Yeah.
And because if it's cyclical, if it's, you know, like you mentioned, it goes all the way back to Civil War times, it does not get solved unless something changes. And sometimes that means society has to come in and say, we will provide strong role models for the next generations. Yeah. I think that that's an important thing. Like, I think strong, and not in a white savior sense, no, yeah, of like, we can fix this, but like that if the cause is fatherlessness, that's all our responsibility,
mm-hmm,
not just one family's responsibility to solve.
Sure. Well, and you know what, the statistic that we heard last week on incarceration rates too, right? I mean, you've got a 1 in 9 chance of a young white boy ending up in prison, and a 1 in 4 chance. I mean, for one.
1 in 21 chance, or 23 chance for white. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay. 1 in 23, and was 1 in 4. Was that correct from the?
Correct.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, and again, this is going to come back to, well, if they weren't doing things that were illegal, they wouldn't go to prison. But if we could fix the ways in which we're sending people to prison disproportionately from a particular community, I think that would have a greater impact on fathers being in the picture for their children if their fathers weren't being sent to jail. Because like we talked about with mandatory minimums, right, that, you know, the drug of choice for a low-income African-American neighborhood had a much higher, still has a much higher sentencing rate and punishing ability and mandate than for cocaine, which is its upper-class white counterpart.
Yeah. In that video, too, he does say, like, at the ages of 20 to 35, 1 in 9 black males are behind bars.
That's okay.
And so, yeah. And so 1 in 9. So that would be the time you're starting families, you're starting careers, and, you know, greater than 10% of that population is in jail at right. some period, you know? So like that's significant. That's a significant portion. So, most people, you know, will become a parent at some point during that frame of mm-hmm. 20 to 35, you know? So yeah, I think that these things do play a part. At least I know we've been kind of talking a lot about this. I don't want to crowd you out here. Any thoughts on this one?
Well, actually, I was really interested to hear your perspective on it because of the list when we talked about what we were going to go over today. This is the one that I understood the least. I was like, oh, no, that's just ridiculous. Yep. Like, how could anybody think that as a rebuttal to, you know, Black Lives Matter? So it was interesting to hear your perspective on it.
Yeah, so, I appreciate that, you know, and again, all of us can disagree, and that's okay. Like, again, I just know what that feels like, and so my heart is for kids without dads.
Right.
My heart is for kids that are come from divorced homes. I think, like, it's hard for a lot of kids in that situation.
Right, and well, and to say, like, well, if George Floyd had, I don't know George Floyd's situation, so I apologize if I'm, you know, disgracing his memory, but you know, if George Floyd had grown up with a father, to say he wouldn't have been killed by the police, I mean, I just don't feel like that's an equitable statement. Like, you know, if George Floyd had a meaningful male figure in his life, would his life have been different? Maybe, but the police officer was not standing there with a knee on his neck saying, "Well, is your father here?" Like, you know, the police officer was not asking him what his raising was about. The police officer was reacting to the situation as it presented itself right then.
Sure.
And, yeah.
All right, so last one. And I think this one also has some interesting connotations to it that I think that is worth discussing, at least. And that is, it's not just a race issue. It's a class issue. That it's about poverty more than it is race. And so we can say disproportionately in our country, Black people are more likely to be poor. In our video that we talked about, I think Black Americans have 10% of the generational wealth as white Americans. And so you're just more likely to be poor if you're Black. But that's the real problem, is class, not just race. So what do you think about this?
I think that those two things have just become so intertwined, you know, over time in our country, you know. Again, going back to the video, they talk a lot about barriers to building wealth that can be passed down over generations, you know, that was, you know, very purposely put in place to disproportionately affect Black people. So I don't know that you can really draw a line and say, no, this is just a class issue, not a race issue. I don't think that that's the case. I had something else I wanted to say, but I can't remember it. So come back to me in a minute.
Sure. Yeah. We'll give you a chance. We'll give you a chance to catch your thoughts. Yeah.
So I think this is a classic situation of trying to catch you in a false dichotomy, right? To say it either has to be class or race. And that's, it's not a sound ground on which to make an argument. It doesn't have to be one or the other. Class absolutely is an issue. Poverty is a very serious issue in the United States, and it's an issue that affects Black Americans and White Americans and Hispanic Americans and Native Americans. You know, poverty is across the board. It is a very, very serious issue, and we should be taking steps to address poverty across the board. I do not have the study to back this up, but I'm going to make an assumption based on the observations that I have had personally and through anecdotes from stories of white and Black people who have grown up in poverty. My guess is if you took an equal group of poverty, of people who are living in poverty who are Black and white, that particularly when we're talking about encounters with the police and the types of experiences that we're sharing right now, those encounters are still going to be higher among the Black population than the white population in that poverty-ridden or poverty-stricken group. And so is poverty an issue? Absolutely. That does not mean that class or that race is not also an issue that is playing into it. It does not have to be one or the other.
Yeah, for sure. Parts of like Appalachia where like the coal mining country and the those things go under, we can certainly see like there's tremendous rises in opiate use and drug use and poverty and crime. Like those things do go hand in hand. Poverty and crime and drug use are attached to one another. Like that's just a given, and not only in the United States but around the world. Like that, those things are connected to each other. But if historically it was easier for white America to amass race than it was from, or not amass wealth than Black America, and these are no fault of maybe any one of us alive today, or any of us who are in our millennials or generation, we didn't cause or do this, but we're beneficiaries of it, sometimes even by default. Even if my family didn't benefit from it, my friends or people who look like me did, and disproportionately to Black America. So I think poverty in some ways wasn't an effect of just poor financial choices on a Black community. In some ways was intentional placed on people of that community within cities and things like that. Like it was not just they just didn't try hard enough, or Black people just didn't work more. It really was like there are real things that happened that kept Black Americans from keeping wealth and homes and jobs, and that made it harder to escape poverty. Because you can't just go from like poor kid to Jeff Bezos. Every kid can't do that. Sometimes it's just like going from poor to less poor. Mm-hmm. And that was harder for the Black community than others. Elise, did you think of your thing that you were thinking of?
I did, yeah. I was going to say, to me, it's like when we talk about white privilege, you're not saying, we have white privilege, the three of us do. We're not saying that you cannot be poor, that you cannot be impoverished, that you cannot experience prejudice. We're just saying that your skin color was never a barrier for you. And I think that is the thing.
Yeah, and I think, I know, especially sometimes people who grew up poor, or whether they grew up poor and became successful or grew up poor and stayed poor, and wealth is not necessarily the only factor of success, maybe they have a harder time with that idea of white privilege because they're going to say, like, I didn't have any privileges. Like, I grew up in poverty. What are you talking about? I had to work for everything I got. Or people say, like, you saying I have white privilege, I worked my butt off and I still stayed in the same economic class my entire life. Yep. Nothing changed. I'm supposed to have an advantage or privilege in that situation. And I can empathize. I think like that does sound dismissive of like a white community growing, being impoverished. Saying like, well, what about us? But I think Elise captured that perfectly. The reasons didn't have anything to do with the color of my skin. There are greater factors at play there. And it wasn't just because you're white, that was not a contributing factor. And it could be no fault of your own. Like it just could be circumstance, could be societal, could be we don't use coal anymore and the town goes under. It could be all those things. But it wasn't because of the color of your skin, or wasn't that was not a contributing factor. So we can say, you know, there are other things out there that people have raised questions in discussion. Some very, very valid. Some, I think, cloaked in bias themselves. But we've wanted to acknowledge that there are criticisms or things that people are wrestling with. And I will say it's okay to wrestle with this. It's okay to say, like, I don't know how I feel about a phrase like defund the police. It's even fair to, I think, for you to say, I'm against it. Like, I think that that's a fair point. But I don't think it's completely fair to say, like, the black community is saying, like, we're hurting, and to that just be dismissed. Now, hows and whys, I think those get into more nuance. For maybe myself and Pastor David and Elise, we see things very clearly one way, or clearer one way than the other. But I'm willing to admit that some critiques can be valid or have weight to them.
Sure.
But that doesn't mean that just because a critique has weight to it, a concept like Black Lives Matter, whether it's a statement or a movement, is just dismissed outright.
Yeah.
Like, I think that that's foolishness. That I think that our black brothers and sisters in America have very real hurt, and very real hurt from not only their interactions with others, but a feeling everywhere they go, the system is playing against them, and there's validity there. Mm-hmm. It's not just playing as if they're a victim. There's real victimhood there.
Yeah.
And I think that does matter. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Patrick, you had brought this up, I don't know, a couple months ago, I think, when we were talking about issues of children at the border and, you know, the idea that most of the people who were coming from the Central American area and were trying to get across the border were probably, you know, Christians. In all likelihood, percentage-wise, they were probably Catholics who were coming to the border. And we were not even having what would seem to be an appropriate response to fellow Christians who are suffering, right? This is not to say that we should only be caring for people who are Christian, but we're completely disregarding even our fellow black Christians who are, you know, telling us these stories and sharing this wisdom with us and saying, this is our experience. And we're completely dismissing them, which completely ignores Paul's cry that there is no longer Jew or Gentile, you know, slave or free, that you are all one in Christ. We're pretending like we're not one in Christ because it's not convenient for us. And you know, that is doing just as much harm and danger. You know, if nothing else, we have to find a way to be willing to listen to the stories that are being told, even if they make us uncomfortable, even if we think they might be wrong, right? Even if we think this story doesn't seem right to me, we still have to find a way to listen to the story and actually hear what is being said, and, you know, find a way to enter into dialogue. If our first reaction is always, yeah, but. If we're always coming back with a retort or a dismissal or a defense, we're missing the point. Like, this is an opportunity for us to hear and give space for grief and enter into a process of healing that is called upon us, you know, for all of us through the process of becoming restorers of the breach, which is, you know, from one of the prophets. I'm forgetting which one. One of them says something beautiful about restoring the breach. It was probably Isaiah. Yeah, that sounds like something Isaiah would have said.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe
yeah,
Jeremiah. I don't know.
They're both prophets.
So. Yeah, they're in there.
Pastor David, I do like that you brought that in, that Christian element too, because in the United States, the percentage of population by race that is most likely to be Christian is the black community.
Mm-hmm.
That they have retained faith at a stronger level than the white and Hispanic communities have. Like, that they are faithful to Jesus. And now it's, I think, the white church. How can we respond to our black brothers and sisters in Christ and support them? At the very least, saying, as a Christian, how can I support my black Christian brothers and sisters and in this and their hurt? And that's part of what it means to be part of that body of Christ.
And
all right, any last thoughts?
Not every black person is going to have the same assessment of the situation either, right?
Sure.
So a couple weeks ago, There was a situation, and several people sent me a link to a video of someone, and I don't remember her name, but she was a black woman who was kind of tearing down this idea, saying, you know, I don't want George Floyd to be the martyr for my people. I don't want George Floyd to represent this because of this, that, and the other. And that's fine. That can be her story. But we can't just look to that one voice to say, well, then racism doesn't exist at all. Right. I mean, you can say, I don't want George Floyd to be the martyr for my people. OK. And you can lay out the reasons that there are other things that are going on here. That's all fine. But that does not dismiss the overarching issue of racism in the United States.
Yeah,
it's I don't know. I'm not saying that clearly, but we not every black person is going to agree on this, just as not every white person is going to agree on this. We have to have the conversations individually, and we have to just be willing to look around and see the reality that, you know, our understanding of how to fix a problem can be different, but the reality is that there is a problem.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I agree with what David said. You know, black people are not a monolith in the same way that white people are not a monolith. You know, there's going to be the whole range of experiences and opinions within. I think we need to be really careful to not pinpoint the one opinion, the one black voice that makes us comfortable or that agrees with our already held opinions and amplify that. We need to listen to the whole gamut.
Sure. And then that goes to if you're left-leaning or right-leaning, both those things, mm-hmm. Regardless, you know, that it's not just finding the voices that echo your chamber, you know, that are already telling you what you want to hear. All right. I think that, this is a long podcast for our usual one, so we'll come to a close right here, if that's okay with everybody. So, Pastor David, where can you find us?
Yeah, hey, if you liked what you heard today, as always, you can find us wherever intelligently, I don't know, I was going to come up with some way to describe the podcast, but I got nothing. So wherever you find podcasts, you can find us there, Apple Play, Apple Music, Google Play, all those things. Of course, you can find us on Facebook and follow us at BeyondSundayPodcast.com. And this week in particular, we would love to hear your responses to our conversations. If you've found yourself using one of these phrases that we're talking about, if you find yourself trying to diffuse situations where these phrases have been used, send us an email, share your stories. You can reach out to us at beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. We would love to have further dialogue about this. We don't want this to be a one-off podcast where we have this conversation and act like everything is solved. We know that this is a dialogue that we're in for the long haul, and we would love to continue to have that be a part of this process.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.